The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to writer Spike Gillespie. She just published her second memoir, Sit, Stay, Heal: How Meditation Changed My Mind, Grew My Heart, and Saved My Ass, about coping with depression, understanding meditation, and the recuperative powers of a good dog memorial tattoo. She's also an old friend dating back to my days as an alternative news editor. Stick around. With a name like Spike, you know she's got to be good. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of anesthetized fellow citizens brought together by the common meditative chant, "Go Dog Go!" in the Nuna Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I always imagined that a woman named Spike Gillespie had to have a great backstory. I just never dreamed I'd actually get to read it. Spike first came into my life when I was editing an alternative newspaper, Jump Monthly. Let me start over again. I changed the wording, it didn't flow as nicely as it should have. And pretend you haven't heard this part before.
Okay.
I always imagined that a woman named Spike Gillespie had to have a great backstory. I just never dreamed I'd actually get to read it. Spike first came into my life when I was editing an alternative newspaper, Jump Monthly. Now, I'm a little fuzzy on the details, 30 years later, but I remember being enamored of her name and the details and narrative style found in her writing. The Jump Monthly was short-lived, and Spike and I went our respective ways. She wrote stories that appeared in the New York Times, the National Geographic, Elle, and Smithsonian Magazine, as well as books such as All the Wrong Men and One Perfect Boy, a memoir, and Pissed Off on Women and Anger. She currently writes two blogs, Keeping Austin Austin and Meditation Kicks Ass. She also officiates weddings in and around her adopted hometown of Austin, Texas. Now, we lost touch for years until Facebook, yes, Facebook, put her name and face in front of me in 2014 as someone I might know, and for once, Facebook was right. Sit, Stay, Heal: How Meditation Changed My Mind, Grew My Heart, and Saved My Ass is a compelling memoir that Spike wrote to accomplish what I think are two big tasks. First, it details her life story: child abuse at the hands of her father, a lifetime of man troubles, alcohol abuse, her love of dogs, and the healing power of knitting. It's also a story of a woman who has endured great pain, some of it undoubtedly brought on by her own actions, but it also presents equal measures of triumph. Now, the second task, I think, is when Spike shares the ways in which meditation has helped her cope with the life she leads. This part isn't all sunshine and roses either, but it does demonstrate the value of introspection and the examined life. Now, my great fondness for Spike over the years never diminished, and I'm pleased to give her a new forum for her work. Spike Gillespie, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Great to see you after so long.
Yeah, wow.
You know, it's interesting how you can have just kind of this moment in a person's life that leaves that just leaves an impact for so long. I've always had a fondness for your work, a fondness for you, and we haven't seen or spoken to each other in almost 30 years. So go
figure. Well, thank you. Yeah.
So I kind of imagine complete strangers reading your book and just wanting to give you a hug. I mean, has that happened?
It actually does happen. And that makes me think of a story I hadn't thought of in a long time. Another person from Tampa was here. Mitch Front and his wife were here many years ago for South by Southwest. It was right around the time my first book came out, All the Wrong Men. And in two completely separate incidents, I was walking down 6th Street. Two strangers stopped me and hugged me and thanked me for writing my book and said that it really told their story too. And so, yeah, people do want to hug me.
It's amazing. I imagine there's a lot of people, and it's part of the reason I want to help get the word out. There's a lot of people who will read this and feel like it really speaks to them. I mean, it's not like everything that happened to you will affect every person, but there's so many things that are probably commonalities for people.
Yes, and I think about that. I have to, even though I've written a lot of books and I've been publishing really super, some people think it's like oversharing or TMI, but it's just what I do. I like to say that I don't have the same filters as other people. And even though I've published so much about my life already and a lot of the stories in the book, versions of them appeared in the blog first, I had some nervousness putting the book out into the world because I'm like, have I done it this time? Is it too personal? Is it too much? And so I was a little bit edgy, but so far people are contacting me and saying, hey, you know, we can relate.
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to ask you about that. As I read it, it feels like you leave a little blood on every page.
And you would be surprised at all the things I don't share. not to be secretive, but just because there's not enough room in the format that I chose, which was I wanted to make the book as lean as possible. If I were to write all of it, it would be, you know, 10,000 pages at least.
Oh, my God. Well, so there's more material.
Yeah, there's a lot of material. A lot more blood.
can you give us a hint of something you left out? I mean, you don't have to give us the details, but what would you leave out of something like this?
Well, this is probably not the very best example, but early on in the book, I talk about this superstition somebody taught me about, which is whatever you're doing on New Year's Day is going to inform the rest of your year. And so the book covers December 2012 right on through to the very end of December 2013. And in an earlier draft, I had included an epilogue, which takes us into January 2014, where on the first day of the year, I run into this character, William, who appears throughout the book.
Terribly handsome William.
Terribly handsome William is shows up in my life all the time in text. But like for us to be in the same room just seems this impossibility. And then curiously or not, after I finally just let go of that whole narrative I've created, sure enough, he just walks. I mean, we run right into each other on New Year's Day and hang out and just, you know. But that's an unbloody example of things not in there. there's just so many. The thing is, I have repeated so many patterns in my life that I just had to pick the juiciest ones to include.
When did you first get the sense as a writer that your life was worth writing about, that people would be interested? Or did you not care?
I'm not sure that I had that sense yet. No, there is that. There was a review of All the Wrong Men that ran in the Texas Observer. And I should advance warn you that I have a long answer.
Sorry.
For everything. But the Texas Observer, which was Molly Ivins, who was my mentor and who's no longer with us, she was very big part of the Texas Observer. And when this review came out, before it was available online, all my friends were like, we can't let you see this. We can't let you see this. And there was this reviewer who said so many mean things about me and was like, why is this woman even writing? So that was in 1999. I recently dug that review up just to show it to one of my writing clients who had a book coming out to reassure her. And I thought, I'm going to read this now and think, I just made I just overreacted to that. Oh my gosh, no. It was the meanest. It was like a complete character assassination, and it had very little to do with the book, and it was just kind of horrible. So there are people out there who definitely say, like, you're, or when I went to the University of South Florida and I did this piece about the Catholic Church, Leo Stalnicker was the advisor for the paper. The state of Florida like blew up. We were getting letters from all over the state that I should be, you know, crucified or whatever. And Leo went on the record with the Tampa Tribune saying that my writing was trash and should never be published. So there are people outside of me who sometimes think I share too much. I shouldn't share at all. And then sometimes I think, you know what, why am I writing this? And then I don't, well, external validation. I always joke that happiness comes from within, but external validation is like a subwoofer for that happiness. So when I hear from people, and I do hear from people who say, you know, thank you so much. I could never say that about myself, but reading your account of it has helped me. Because I write a lot about grief and trauma, PTSD, depression, and not everybody wants to share their story. I seem unable to stop.
I was just thinking that the biggest criticism I get on Mr. Media is people complaining about the kind of introduction that I gave you, where I try to explain why, you know, how we know each other, what the connection is, and why I was so much more interested in your work than if it just the book had just, you know, landed on my desk. Oh my God, people hate that. I get that all the time.
Yeah.
Why doesn't he just shut up and let her talk? And it's just like, context? Anybody? No,
I know. You know. Haters are going to hate. You
That's
know?
Right. I mean, yeah. And it's people who write reviews of things who just make it personal and they can't seem to write about the work itself. It's just like you're in the wrong business. You know?
Oh, I know. And it, yes, I love Ian McEwan so much, but I really delayed reading his book, Sweet Tooth, because I read this scathing review. And I think I just thought, I don't want, if it's really this bad, I don't want it to, I don't want to knock the pedestal out from under him. But finally, I'd run out of Ian McEwan to read. So I read this book, Sweet Tooth, and I loved every single word of it. So I went back and I dug up that review, and it was by Maureen Corrigan on NPR. And I just thought, I will never listen to you again. I will never, like, I was pretty pissed off at her because I should know by now not to listen to the critics. I mean, for me or for other people's work, you just have to. And then Birdman, everybody loves Birdman. I want my money back.
Oh.
There you go.
No, I understand. I mean, it's just, you know, everybody has different tastes. There's a movie critic that I used to read. I don't even read him anymore because I found that everything he liked, I hated, and everything he hated, I liked. And I thought,
yep,
all I need to know is, you know, if did you give it an A or an F? Because if you gave it an A, I won't go see it. If you gave it a D through an F, I'll probably love it. So, mm-hmm. What was the hardest thing to write in this book? And I mean, and I'll just for people who are joining us, I mean, there's stuff in there about your relationships. There's stuff in there about your childhood. There's stuff about meditation. There's, I mean, your relationship with your son, with boyfriends, with husbands. I mean, there's a lot with alcohol. I mean, but what was the hardest thing to write, even after all this much time?
So I have a two-part answer. One is like in the overall big picture, I used to be a lot more cavalier when I was younger about, you know, write about people like they're dead. Just write. But that has cost me a lot in my life. I'm not negatively estranged from my family, if that makes sense, but we're not terribly close. And part of that has been fed by the fact that I have written so much about my dad, about the family dynamic. And then with my son, he came to me. He grew up in the spotlight. I wrote a column mostly about him for the Dallas Morning News. And when he was about 13, he's like, Mom, it's enough. He wasn't angry or anything. He was just like, it's my private life now. So I called him right before I published this book. And I said, if you want to pre-screen it, you can. But I want to let you know that all the scenes that you're in, I don't quote him. I mean, I couldn't take him out of the book, like that trip to London that we went on. But I will always talk about my feelings in those scenes. Because the older I get, or terribly handsome William or Ira, like any of those characters, I really didn't want to be hurtful to them. But there are definitely scenes that if they were to read them, I think would be hurtful. And, you know, people love to pass that Anne Lamott quote around the internet. If people wanted you to write about them differently, they should have been nicer. And I, you know, at the risk of sounding like a cornball, if people only wrote about the younger me, I would just be constantly depicted as an asshole. Like, I really believe people can change and grow. So in the overall book, I tried, especially when I was doing the fourth draft of it, I really cut out some specifics about some people because I wanted to illustrate the theme of the story and my hurt feelings. But I wanted to be more careful about it. A specific scene that was very hard to write and to edit and to go, and I never want to read it again, is the scene where my dog Bubbles dies. Like, I don't cry a lot anymore, but every time I had to go back to that scene, it was just like a knife to the gut all over again. She was my soul dog.
Mm. It was hard to read. I've got a terrier who's we think he's 12 or 13, and he's slowed down tremendously in the last year. And you know, I walk him, and he shakes, and he's actually starting to sit down if I start a conversation with somebody on the walk, because he just can't handle standing there. And I was reading that, and I'm going, yeah, you know, I'm heading to that place, and it's brutal.
It's brutal. And in her case, it was so sudden. And I was so busy watching my other dog who was actively dying, and we knew she was going. I had this idea that Bubbles would just live forever. I was going to buy her a little stroller, and just she would be like 200. And I definitely had a lot of magical thinking around Bubbles. And so it was so hard to lose her.
And so what was the easiest part to write?
You know, like the booze stuff is pretty easy to write because I've been writing about my drinking for, you know, ever. What else is easy to write? You know, so the passages, originally the book was just going to be a straight memoir. And then I veered down this path where my friend Chris McDougall, who wrote the book Born to Run, it's like this huge international bestseller. And I had always planned to self-publish this book. Like from the Kickstarter, the whole idea was it wasn't going to be a default or like, oh, I guess I have to self-publish it. I'm a DIY person. But Chris is like, look, I've got all these connections in New York. You might as well meet with them. And so I did. I met with the vice president of Random House and another top executive there. And I met with this agent who, it was a very bristly meeting. I did not love meeting her, but she made these suggestions. And I usually I'm usually so defiant that the minute somebody says to me, like if they say, don't trip over that curb, I might just have to go trip over the curb just to prove them wrong. So to sit in a meeting.
Is that the old you or is that the new you?
Well, that's the old me.
Okay.
And by old, I mean just like as recently as, 6 months ago. Or but this woman was making these suggestions, and I was kind of on the inside, like thinking, oh, fuck you, just shut up. And but when I went home, so there was another woman I met in New York, an attorney who helped me a lot. And she had similar suggestions that she presented in a way more positive way. It was this great experiment in how we present information. Like if you're arguing with a two-year-old, I was watching my own self. How was my reaction to these two very different women who are essentially giving me the same advice, which was, there's a lot in the book about tattooing, and they're like, you really got the tattooing stuff down, but there's no instruction about meditation. And I was like, well, what instruction do you need? You just sit down and you breathe, right? It's not that hard. But that said, I decided to take into account this suggestion, and I wound up writing 12 mini lessons on how to meditate. And that part, I wrote that really, really fast, and it was so easy because it was just like taking dictation. Mm.
And it reads easy. I'm not someone who has actively meditated. I find it interesting, and I'll stop myself and relax and think and calm down about things. I don't think of it necessarily as active meditation. But the instructions were very interesting, and you know, it's very easy to read. By the way, when we're done and we're off the air, I want to know who that agent is.
I almost want to tell you on the air, but I'm not going to do it. No, I'm not going to do it.
Don't. I'll tell you why later that you shouldn't tell me on the air.
Okay.
As you write something like this, and as you wrote, you know, the earlier memoir, All the Wrong Men, and One Perfect Boy, do you have any regrets either from life or things that you've revealed? Anything you'd like to go back and change either in life or in print? Or are you just like, hey, that's just the way it was?
Well, you know, it's funny. I like to, again, getting back to the part of me that tries to be cavalier, I like to say I don't have regrets. But that's not just being cavalier. It's like I can't change what I already wrote. And I have a friend of mine, though, who says regrets are actually good because those are like guideposts for us in our life. If you're feeling regret over something, maybe you can use that to help, you know, from repeating it. But I'm just trying to think. I don't really regret. I think that there would have been a big already a big disconnect with my family of origin. And even if I hadn't written the books, there would still be like, you know, the locking of horns. But I'm very keenly aware that it seems definite that the writing of these books and essays exacerbated or grew the hole. I mean, I really feel like I'll never be part of the home planet again. But that doesn't mean I would go back and change what I wrote. I'm trying to think if I would. I will say, sometimes I wish I could go back and change the journals that I've kept. Like I have this one journal from the last time I was married, which I hope is the last time. and it's like very fifth grade girl, like, oh, I really like him and he's so cute. And, you know, later on I'm thinking, God, he's such an asshole. I can't stand him. So I would hate to die. And I mean, not that anyone's going to go through my journals, but like look at that and think, oh, wow, she really loved him. I would like to just, I thought about burning my journals.
Have any of the names been changed in this book?
Yes, many of the names have been changed. Often what I'll do is like, so for the scenes in the tattoo parlor, Bart and Noska really are Bart and Noska, but I changed the names of the other artists because that was just at their request. And they actually, they weren't worried about anything. I think they just had fun coming up with pseudonyms. I changed Ira's name and his parents' name.
That was the one I was going to ask you about. I had a real strong feeling that those were not their actual names.
Right. And they're not, but a lot of the other details are, you know, are very accurate about them. My son's name is the same. I refer to my son's father as Big Red throughout the book, but I reveal his name in the dedication because it's dedicated to three people and he's one of them, but I clear that with him. People I like, I clear it with them before I use their real name. People I have a hard time with, you know, Peter, I changed. Oh, well, you probably haven't got to the Peter part yet, but I did change Peter's name, and I actually changed some characteristics that don't affect the integrity of the story or the lack of integrity, if you will. But I just did that because, you know, again, the older I get, the more I really clearly see it's about the themes more than the specific people.
Well, I suspected that Ira and his parents, Ira for folks who don't know what we're talking about, Ira was your domestic partner for how long? Two, four, six years.
6 years.
Okay. The treatment of him is fine. You know, it is what it is. When you're dealing with his parents, I thought I was tipped off that these are not real names because these people. First of all, I just wanted to smack them myself.
Yeah.
But I just figured you probably were not naming them by name there.
I didn't. And, you know, one day they might get their hands on it. Ira and I are still very good friends. And, we had a break. We had a silent period. He was just here the other day bringing me a birthday gift. I mean, it's up to him whether or not he chooses to read the book. But I've suggested that I would prefer he didn't, only because I don't. It's so funny. I feel like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. It's like, if you don't want to be hurtful, well, why write it? And it's because it's my story. It's what I do. So I did it.
And your son is 24, 25?
He's 24, my little tiny baby, Henry.
That's crazy. Now, has he managed to avoid some of the things that you went through in his teens and early 20s? Or has he found his way to some of his mother's adventures?
Well, it's funny you would ask that. I was just talking today to some wedding clients and we were talking about our kids. And I say that like sometimes Henry has sometimes I'll look at his Instagram and like one night I got a text message from him saying, don't worry when you look at the Instagram. And I'm not even going to tell you what the picture was. or when he had a record come out, he was getting interviewed. And I read this interview with him in, the Riverside Times or some other St. Louis magazine. And there were some things in there I was like, oh, I can't unsee that. But that said, I might be fooling myself, but I feel like I was way more, I think I took a lot more risks than he takes, which isn't to say he doesn't take risks, but I just think, and another thing is like, and I'm not saying this in a blaming way, but you know, I was binge drinking from the age of 14, and it's not that my parents were aware that I was doing that, but whatever signs I was giving off, there was, you know, I remember coming into school hungover and my economics teacher, this is high school, saying, hey, I heard you threw up at a party on Saturday. Ha ha ha. Like instead of say, maybe you need some counseling or teenage AA. Whereas with my son, I have told him from, I don't know, the time he was very little, like, you come from a family on both sides of the family tree that are very prone to addiction and depression. If you ever run into trouble, we're here to help. You know, it's up to him if he does run into trouble, it's up to him if he wants to ask for it. But I've always been very, very open about alcoholism and you know, depression, seasonal affective disorder. And probably I probably over instructed him about the use of condoms.
You know, that's something that no son wants to hear from mom, over instruction on how to use a condom.
Well,
you know what? More than anything I read in the book, that's over the line.
Well, I think he was like 8 or 9 one night.
Oh my God.
When I was like, I was overcorrecting, right? Because I, like, I'm 51. I no longer have a uterus, and I'm still waiting for my mom to tell me about my first period. Like, what's it going to be like? So I very much am the queen of overcorrection, which I'm trying to overcorrecting now. But when he was maybe 9 years old, at dinner one night, I just grabbed a banana and a condom, and I just, and he's like, you know, I'm nine.
Yeah, I'm feel for that kid right now. I don't know.
I think he has a pretty good sense of humor. I mean, we just had dinner last night. He's in town for a week, and sometimes he rolls his eyes, but we laugh, and you know, we tattooed each other recently. We did. We're both artists, right? And so in addition to my writing, he does visual art, graffiti, and makes records. And so I was like, well, what if we do a performance art piece together where we tattoo each other? And I said, why don't you tattoo me? And he said, I'll do it on the condition that you tattoo me. And one of my best friends is a tattoo artist. And he was like, okay, we can make that happen.
Wow. That's a new one on me. I've never heard of a mother and son tattooing each other. Mother and son tattoos. Yeah, I guess that's not hard to imagine. But okay. Now the book, it goes in and out of life's experiences. Obviously, you wrote this whole book about men and your son, but this it goes in and out and gives people who had not read that book perspective on other things. Mostly, it reflects on the last 2 years or the 2 years leading up to. Mm-hmm. Publication. For people who don't know what we're talking about, what happened in your life that triggered this period of time and this particular focus for the book?
So, good question. Thank you. I have had cyclical depression. Probably, I try to look back and think, when did it start? And I'm going to say adolescence. Like, I understand we all create narratives and there's revisionist history that happens. But to the best of my ability to put a framework on it, probably when I started binge drinking at 14, some depression was kicking in, some self-medication. In addition to peer pressure, growing up in South Jersey where the drinking age is 18, so you can get, you know, a fake ID and all that. I mean, there's a lot of factors that fed into that. But so I'd had these bouts of depression for, the book starts at the end of 2012 when I was 49. And once again, I was depressed. And at that point, I'd been sober for maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13 years. And I was so sick of it. So in there were a couple things going on. There's seasonal affective disorder. December's always very hard for me. It triggers my PTSD around my childhood abuse. I remember there was the school shootings in Newtown, is that what it's called, in Connecticut?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also, Ira and I were having a lot of, we'd already argued for like 6 years, but there was this, my brain was not working right at that time. And I spotted this photograph on Facebook that We've done many, many goofy photos. I've done photos that people have found offensive. Like, I understand that everybody has their boundaries and lines get crossed. But in that moment of me seeing this photograph of him with this young woman, and she's looking at the camera like, hey, we just got it on. And even though I knew that wasn't the reality of what happened, it flipped a switch in my mind. And I just freaked out. So it was this culmination of events. And then I really couldn't get out of bed. I forced myself to get out of bed to go to work. And I would kind of force myself to be as happy as I could, because my job is happy and my job is to be present for people. But then I go straight back to bed and I was just losing it. So I decided I am going to meditate. I already was meditating off and on for a dozen years, but I'm like, I'm going to really do this with intent. I'm going to see if I can use this tool to fix my mind. And a friend of mine who'd done this 10-day silent retreat, my friend has PTSD also, he said, it will do so much to help you. So I signed up. And then the retreat didn't happen until June. But as this was going, I talked to a therapist friend of mine, and I said, I want to write a book about this. And he said, you know what? If you want to, you can just take the year to heal. Like, you don't have to always be documenting everything. And I thought that was good advice. But I still wanted to write about it even after the year had passed. And so I can't even remember the original question. Forgive me.
So, let me think.
Yeah, what was the original question?
Just what it was that triggered the writing of this book about this particular period of time.
So I decided, and there was a time years ago, like 8 years ago, when I was trying to write a book about my PTSD. And I remember sending it to an acquaintance agent. And I think the idea is, when you're writing a book like this, and even my early readers agreed, or like, man, this is heavy and dark. Like, it's not there. Many, many years ago, I read an interview with Cynthia Heimel, who wrote for Playboy.
Sure,
and
sure.
She talked about how, like, Hollywood imagines there's this dumbed down family in middle America that everything has to be dumbed down to. That's not true, right? There's a lot of intelligent readers. And yet still, I think so many books that make it to like bestseller status or get bought by the big houses, so many of them seem to have this formulaic Hollywood version of things, and you're not allowed to be so dark. And so I love to go off on tangents. I still have I've forgotten the next question, but I wanted to. Years ago, I thought about writing this PTSD book, and the guy was like, "Whoa, too much! Like, this is heavy." And I wasn't ready then because I was still going through a lot. So I decided, I asked some friends, I was like, I think I'm ready to write this book. And they encouraged me. They're like, you're ready to write this book. And so then I put it out to the crowd in a Kickstarter. I'm like, I think I'm ready to write this book. I could use some help. And people responded really overwhelmingly.
Well, so here you are, you've written this book with 12 meditation lessons. You mentioned you've been meditating for about 12 years. Was there a point when you 12 years ago would have just looked askance at someone trying to get other people to meditate? And
yes.
You know, how different is this for you to be that person who's, you know, pimping meditation?
Yeah, it's funny. Well, first of all, meditation right now is suddenly like the new hot topic. You know, I'm listening to Russell Brand's new book, Revolution, and it's like everybody's going to be doing it in the next 5 minutes. But when the very first time I did a guided meditation, it was the first night of this yoga class I was taking, and I talk about this in the book. And this teacher was supposed to be so amazing. She didn't show up. I mean, she couldn't show up. She was stuck. A storm had kept her away. So this student, a seasoned student, got up and she's like, okay, you know, it's nap time or whatever. Shavasana, I call it nap time. And she does this guided meditation. And I'm really thinking like, oh, guided meditation, like the monkeys are going to fly out of my ass and rub my feet, right? But then I got
and rub your feet. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. So I got.
See, folks, that's the difference between Spike and someone else, Spike Gillespie and someone else named Spike writing. It's not just that monkeys are going to fly out of her ass; it's that then they're going to massage your feet.
Yeah, while I'm
just to clarify.
But I did. I got so sucked into that that visualization. It was so moving for me, and so. To be that person. So when I announced to a friend of mine that I was going to start teaching meditation, which I do teach meditation, this friend got very freaked out and said, you know, you're going to bring a lot of negative stuff into your life. You're not qualified. And she took me to lunch with, and this is in the book too. She took me to lunch with this woman who had been married to a famous Indian writer who had he had since died of illness and old age. And she really got in my face and was like, my husband would not approve of this. And I was like, I became what I call like an Irish Buddhist or a Jersey Buddhist. Like I got in her face and was like, you know, India did not corner the market on breathing. And if I want to do the secular version, I get it that some people are protective of it and precious about it. But I'm like, to compare it to knitting, it's not like I'm inviting people to come in and learn how to make a cable sweater on the first try. It's like I'm giving people the most basic building blocks so that if they want to pursue a guru or whatever, they can do that. But I do feel like I feel okay pimping it.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up in a second, but I got to cover a couple little things here first. First of all, do you want to take a deep breath and show everybody your T-shirt?
Oh, yes. Okay. Ready?
Yeah. There we go. MeditationKicksAss.com.
Oh, there. Let me move the headphones. Like, there you go. All right. Okay. All right. Got it. Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure. We got that in. And then also for occasional Mr. Media guest, AJ Jacobs from Esquire magazine, do you want to describe the desk that you're working at?
Oh, yes. I am at my standing desk right now. I used to work at a standing desk all the time, and then some friends gave me a king-size memory foam mattress, and I spend about 20 hours a day. I wrote the book in the bed. I eat my meals in the bed. It's incredible. It's hard to get out of.
I want to set up my desk as a standing desk. I read AJ's book, which I can't remember the title of it now, but he had a whole big thing about how he converted to standing desks. And when you told me that's what you're on, I wanted to point that out. And then the last thing is just one of the really great parts of the book, besides the writing and the meditation lessons, is these series of photos that you started creating almost by accident. It was just someone had planted an idea with you and you started taking photos, and each chapter has one of these photos. You want to just describe it for a second?
Sure. And this is the glory of e-publishing, is you can put in 1,000 photos if you want at no extra cost. So my friend Robert, who got me blogging, I sound like Al Gore, but I've been blogging since 95. And then when everybody was doing it, I'm like, it's beneath me. And then my friend Robert's like, no, it's not beneath you. You need to blog. So that started one blog. And then that tapered off. And when Robert saw that I had started just posting photos of myself meditating, you know, at my house, he said, do you take requests? And is this like planking or owling? I don't know if you know about planking and owling.
No.
Well, you can Google it. Anyway. No. So he said, how about McDonald's? And I was like, ding, a great idea was born. So I just started, there are pictures of me in all sorts of places, like at Buckingham Palace, at Malcolm McLaren's grave. I'm just trying to think of other examples. In the bathroom, on the table at the gynecologist's office, the doctor's like, are you okay in there? Are you okay? So, yeah, lots of crazy pictures.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, it's a nice, I don't know, kind of break from some of the heaviness in the book. So I just
emotional palate cleanser.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that. Now, the last thing I want to bring up before we bid adieu here is your day job is officiating weddings, right?
And funerals.
Funerals. I didn't know about that.
Well, that's a more recent addition. But yes, I'll be doing a funeral in a couple weeks.
All right. So, you know, if someone's watched this and they got to this point and they're thinking, I want her to marry me to so-and-so. Not, I don't want her to marry me. Although in many states, that anything goes now. And
yeah.
You don't want to get married.
That's correct. I'm done with that. So but, thanks for all the offers. But
so is there how do people reach you for officiating a wedding?
Easy. SpikeGillespie.com. Thanks for asking. Yeah, it's my name.com, SpikeGillespie.com.
Right. Mm-hmm. So just one more URL we need to share with folks. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, folks, listen. You can find Sit, Stay, Heal, How Meditation Changed My Mind, Grew My Heart, and Saved My Ass. I like that last part. And Saved My Ass by Spike Gillespie, as well as her numerous other books, including, yes, several on quilting. Don't ask. In great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching on MrMedia.com, you probably know how this works, but below the video over there is a photo of Sit, Stay, Heal and other books. I will probably have other books there as well. Click on it. At the moment, Sit, Stay, Heal is an ebook. It'll probably eventually be a paperback. You can click on that and you can have it instantly. Or if you're watching this sometime after we've seen this, it may be available as a paperback. I understand Amazon can deliver it to you by drone in about 30 minutes or less. So you take that up with them. Spike, we've got a number of websites to share with people, right? There's SpikeGillespie.com. There is KeepAustinAustin.com. Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, you want to show us the shirt again?
Oh, yes. There's meditationkicksass.com. And also, I know that's plenty, but I just want to let you know that two of my three dogs have blogs. The Boston Terrier's blog is goodgirlrebound.com. And then I have this 9-million-year-old Great Pyrenees I just adopted. And his URL is stillgotmyballs.com.
God, oh, damn it. You know, I tried to get that for myself, and now I know why it wasn't available.
Sorry, Tiny beat you to it.
Damn you, Spike Gillespie. So I know you're on Facebook because that's how we connected, so people can find you there. Are you on Twitter or any other social media?
Yes, I do the tweeting, and I think I'm at Spike Gillespie on Twitter, and then I'm on the Instagram. I'm on Ello, so la-di-da. I don't know if you're on Ello yet.
I don't know and Ello.
Ella is like the alternative to Facebook. And where else am I? You know, I'm just I'm highly Googleable.
So you are. So you are. Spike Gillespie, just great to see you. Terrific to talk. It's funny how this social media connects people from, you know.
I love it.
There's no part of the past that is left behind anymore, which is good and bad, of course.
Good and bad, yeah.
Congratulations on the latest book, and thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
We say fucking namaste in Austin.
I would repeat that, but I'd probably choke on my own words. Thank you, and great to see you.
You too, and we're off now, right? Are we? Is that it?
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Melser crying about the O's again.
Whew. Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.